Have you ever wondered what it was like to do a higher degree research qualification or why someone might consider doing one? In this podcast, we open up the world of doctoral research by delving into the stories behind the research, speaking to current CSU candidates as they navigate the trials and tribulations of their research journeys. Listen to the why, what, and how of these innovative researchers, as well as what spurred them on to pursue this research pathway. This is Stories Behind the Research on the CSU Research Hub and 2MCE FM.
I'm Dawn Tukenew from the Research Development Team at CSU, and today I'm here with Meryn Randall. She's a full-time PhD candidate in the School of Information and Communication Studies. Meryn's proposed research title is What Are the Lived Experiences of Adult Sentenced Prisoners in Australia When Attempting to Satisfy Their Legal Information Needs? So welcome and thank you for joining me today, Meryn. I'm really looking forward to hearing about yourself, your research and your journey so far, and to, of course, to share your story with some of our listeners today. Before we talk about your research, maybe we could start off with you.
Sure. Thanks for talking with me today, Dawn. I'm looking forward to sharing. As you've said, my name is Meryn and I live in Melbourne. I am what would be regarded a couple of decades ago a mature age student. You know, I'm not in my 20s. I have two adult offspring, and my daughter is a forensic behavioural specialist and she lives in Melbourne. And my son is a production manager in film and television and he lives in London. And wow. I also have a 12-year-old Siamese cat who thinks the entire world revolves around her, literally. So I've worked as a legal researcher, librarian, trainer for nearly three decades. And before I started as a librarian, I qualified as a teacher. I have had my own small project management company, and I was also a lecturer at RMIT for a short while. I have a bit of a background in being organised, I suppose you could say.
Great. And lots of different experiences across a whole heap of areas too.
Yes. So with regards to hobbies, my study is my hobby, really. There's not a lot of time for anything else.
And so when did you start research? When did you start your project?
This research study I started in 2023, and I'm studying by distance. But I come up to Wagga on occasion. I think that's an exaggeration, maybe twice. I try to get up there.
So what or maybe who inspired you to do this particular research?
From a couple of aspects, really it's a bit of a bucket list item. Actually, it's the only item on my bucket list. So once that gets checked off, there's nothing more to live for, really. But For a while I was working in a library in Brisbane. When I was working there, I found a drawer of letters from prisoners requesting help with research. And like the drawer hadn't, I don't think anyone had opened it in ages. So I sorted through it, responded to the prisoners. And from that, it made me start to think, well, what resources do prisoners have with regard to getting legal information? So that kind of like just churned around in my mind for a few years. And then I came back to Melbourne for family reasons to look after my mother. So I needed to find, obviously, another job in Melbourne. And what happened was is, even though I've had two decades of experience under my belt, I had never qualified as a librarian because when I started, you didn't need to have those qualifications. And I got in on my research master's and my background. So I had to bite the bullet and go back and do my qualifications. When I was at RMIT, I ran into Jane Garner and she was one of my lecturers. And I found out that she also has done studies in prisons and we kind of had a like interest. So, you know, we got chatting. And so now, you know, here I am at CSU with Jane as one of my supervisors and Simon Wakeling is my other supervisor. So it's kind of a few things, but really ultimately it was just a nugget of inquiry I had in my head. And due to the fact that I couldn't work in my field of expertise and had to go and do a degree in it, I bumped into Jane. So it was just like the universe collided at the right time. It was really just...
And finding all those letters.
If I hadn't have really ultimately been bored at work one day and just started cleaning out things that hadn't been looked at for ages, and I found this drawer of letters, although my boss then actually now works at CSU, and I certainly hope he doesn't hear me saying I was bored at work one day. He will probably say, yes, that sounds about right.
I'm sure that's all water under the bridge now.
I don't know.
So how would you explain your research topic to our listeners?
Okay, so my research topic is listening to and finding out the experience of sentenced prisoners. So not prisoners who are on remand and have access to legal resources. These are prisoners who have been sentenced and they will have other matters that have arisen, and that could be a variety of things. They don't necessarily qualify for legal aid, or they can't afford a solicitor, or they just want to know more about their what's happening with their legal matter. So they need to find legal research. How do they do that? Do they write to, I don't know, the Supreme Court library somewhere saying, can you help me, whether they know they'll get a reply or not. So I'm looking at those experiences of the prisoners and how they've tried or needed to or tried to find legal resources. And on top of that, it's a qualitative study, but it's specifically a phenomenological study. And I know, Dawn, you can't say that word, and it is a tricky word to say, so I'm not going to ask you to repeat it.
Thank you.
That's all right. And phenomenological means that I'm looking at a phenomenon at a particular point in time, or, you know, in everyone is in the same community. So they're experiencing a like thing. And that's the difference from, say, a general qualitative study where I could go out and chat to lots of different people all over the place. This kind of has to be all in the same place. And it works well in a closed community, which is what a prison is.
So why is that important to you?
It's important because I want to know about the experience. This is a really tricky one to explain, this one. It's important to me because we don't really understand the lives of prisoners. We might think we do because we watch television or we've read books or we've been to the films or whatever. But, you know, unless you actually speak to somebody who has had that experience, we don't know. I think it's important to know that. Most studies that have been conducted into prisons is basically quantitative. Those researchers, they might run their own surveys or their own quantitative research, but generally they are supplied with data that the government has collected and they find their results and outcomes from that. Very few people have actually been into prisons and spoken with prisoners. That's really missing in the research. So prison research generally has this big gap, and it seems a bit one-sided. So to fully understand, we all know we need to speak to somebody. You're speaking to me to try and fully understand why I'm doing this. Mm-hmm. I'm probably not really giving you a very good explanation, but it's the same principle. I would like to know, and I think it's important to know, because otherwise policies or guidelines or procedures are being based on no knowledge of actually what is happening.
I imagine in these early stages you would have done a lot of research yourself into what research has already taken place. And you mentioned that this is one of the major gaps that you have found. Is there any other major gaps that influencing your research?
So Jane Garner has done research in prisons into libraries and the way people have used libraries in prison. And it was also phenomenological, and it was very, very interesting. Really, Jane is about the only other person that I have found in Australia that has done this type of research. I haven't really found any other studies overseas. There's a person in the UK, Finlay, who has also actually been in and spoken with prisoners. And I know there's another PhD candidate now at CSU who is going to do the same thing. So we're kind of on this cusp of people actually going in and talking with prisoners. So there is that gap. There is that, because most studies have been quantitative, there's no information out there. So it kind of needs to be put out there so that we understand. And that's the biggest gap, is that most studies have been quantitative.
You're listening to Stories Behind the Research on the CSU Research Hub.
So how's your research progressed so far?
This is why I thought it might be interesting to come and chat to you, Dawn, because other people might end up in the same situation as I currently am in, because they might be doing closed institution research. You know, everybody's research is different. For me, and from research I've done in the past, you get ethics and you get it from the university and you might actually know where you're going to go. And it might be just one other place or maybe two. For me, every state and territory in Australia has its own Department of Justice, and to go into a prison in that state or territory, you have to apply to each state and territory, to each Department of Justice. So everybody is different. So if I wanted to go everywhere in Australia, not only would I have my CSU ethics, I would also have to apply to eight other places. Fortunately, there is the luck that there's a couple of territories and states that you can't go into at the moment. They're just not accepting research. So that's kind of cut my choices down. Yep. So I've applied to South Australia, Tasmania, Victoria, and New South Wales. So that's four more applications I've had to make. Each one of those states, it's a tri-level. So within it, I have to apply three times within each state. So that's making it 12.
Wow.
And each one of those levels, it comes back and forth until the first level says, yes, we're happy with this. You can now progress to the next level. And then that will come back and forth limitless times until they say, yes, we're happy with that, and we'll progress it to the final level. So the final level is getting the commissioner of the department to sign off on that. So I've reached one state, I've reached that level, and that has taken 8 months to get to that, for that one state. It's been with the commissioner for sign off now for nearly a month, for a month, actually this week, a month. And the commissioner might come back and say no. And so then I've lost that state. Unless I start all over again, I can't go back to that state because I just don't have time to go back to that state. Yeah, it takes a lot of patience, a lot of screaming into your pillow, because they make changes. Like one state, everything was going along fine, and then they came back and said, well, you can't refer to people in your application as prisoners. And so I had to then go back and redo the application again and take out the term prisoner everywhere, even though the questions in their application refer to people as prisoners. I can't respond with the word prisoner. You know, it's very frustrating. So it's a really long process with a lot of guesswork, a lot of patience, and no guarantee of any positive outcome at all. So with my other three states, one I've got, I'm still in the first stage, and the other two I'm in the second stage, and yep, still just back and forth, back and forth.
Wow. Did you realise it was going to be so challenging?
Look, I did, because Jane, my supervisor, had been through it, and her studies was in New South Wales and Victoria. So we knew it could take a while, and I knew it would be frustrating, but it is exhausting. And I think it's kind of a bit unique to closed institutions. So if anyone else, that's why I kind of thought, like, you just have to take a deep breath all the time. And you might think some of it just, like, why would you want that change? Like one state, but I'm in the second tier. It was great. I thought I was getting along really well. And then just actually, no, we now actually don't want you to do any of that. We want you to use our internal messaging system. So I've had to then find out all about how that messaging system works, and will it work for me? How will it work for me? So we're in the process now of reworking out how I can do recruitment using this system. So, of course, what happens on all of those layers is that I have to apply for variations from CSU. So even though I might end up getting approval, I then have to actually go back to CSU and say, oh, I have in this one application 23 variations I need you to consider. And if they turn around and say, oh, no, actually, you can't do that, then again, it's take a deep breath and go back and negotiate back and forth. We know for academic rigor, it needs to be pretty much the same. If I change one in one, I need to go back to the other and say, oh, can I do this here? Can I do that? So it's a big juggling act to try and get that. But then lots to write about, you know, lots in the methodology chapter to write about, I suppose.
And I guess in the meantime, you're just using a lot of your time just to track all of these things.
Yeah. I spend a lot of time tracking. I have a lot of tables made up of, you know, when we contacted, what was the outcome, a lot of response tables, trying to keep motivated to keep up to date so that my literature review is up to date. If there's been any changes, if anybody's kind of weirdly published something on exactly what I'm doing. And then, of course, that impacts it as well. So far, fingers crossed, no one has. Yeah, it's hard. Yeah, this sort of last 7 months has been pretty tough, but you get there.
So how do you stay motivated? How do you keep going?
Well, I suppose for me, it's a little bit different because, as I said before, it's a bucket list item. I started my first PhD in 1994 and couldn't do it because I had a revolting one-year-old child that, you know, well, I shouldn't say he's revolting. He's lovely, but I just couldn't parent two children on my own when one was a little bit of a rat bag and study and do everything. So I sort of stopped then. And then I thought, look, it's only a decade. I'll give it 10 years, I'll be fine. And then I started again 10 years later. And then my daughter got ill. And that was obviously I had to focus on her. And then after that, it's 30 years. In actual fact, this year is 30 years since I first started my first PhD.
Wow.
So and it's changed a lot. Like it really, the way you do it's really changed. So for me, it's a bit of a bucket list. So I can stay motivated because I need to finish it. I have to finish it. I won't not finish it for a third time. I think if I was, you know, in my 20s, I would be much more frustrated by this and be feeling, because I'd be feeling like, oh, this is my career. It's the beginning of my career. And if I can't get this done, I can't do this, this and this. And I kind of feel like I want to save the world. I don't feel like I need to save the world. And it's not the end. It's the end of my career, not the start. So I can hang in there. Let's put it that way.
Have you thought about worst case scenario and you don't get any of these approvals? How's that going to impact things?
We're kind of chatting about that with my supervisors, you know, what if nothing happens? And Jane is terrifically optimistic and says, no, just wait, it will be fine, it will be fine. It was always expected that it may not happen. Prisons can just shut down research at any point in time. They can just do it. Like the ACT used to be great at having researchers come in, but they're a no-go at the moment. And I could have interviews lined up and turn up and the prison's gone into lockdown for a week. So there's so many factors. But on the bigger factor, if I don't get into any prisons at all, then, yes, I just have to see what I can actually do with my topic and what I've done and how I've done it. It probably wouldn't be a phenomenological because I can't get into the community.
Mm.
I could perhaps look at prisoners who've been released and they could do a reflective, qualitative, when you were in prison, how did you do this? Not you're in prison now, how do you do it? So it's there and I'll definitely finish and do something. Will it ideally be what I set out to do? No, but no one's topic that they think they're going to do ends up being exactly what they had in their mind in the first place. It's got to change anyway. Mm. I'm not fazed by that. Look, I'll be a bit disappointed, but I won't be fazed by it because, I'll find something, definitely find something. And, you know, I have to look at if I hang in a bit longer, will I need to apply for an extension for an extra semester? So that's kind of all happening in the background as well. So I just thought, you know, some people who might be thinking, oh, I might go in and do prison research, or I might go in and do close community research, because this would also apply mental health institutions and things like hospitals and things like that. And it's all centred around confidentiality and protecting that individual, which is perfectly valid and that should be there.
Yes, absolutely,
which, you know, has changed over the decades. I was talking to a friend of mine recently who did their PhD in the 1990s in health institutions and pretty much literally just knocked on the door and interviewed people, you know. So, I mean, we all know that the ethics laws have changed. We know all of that has changed since then, and rightfully so. But it does, you know, work against us in some ways because we then don't find out about people.
So going back to your research, Marianne, and I don't know a lot about your topic, don't the prisoners have access to legal aid or lawyers or libraries or...
Right. So every prison is different and every prison in Australia and across the world, like there's guidelines that start at the United Nations level and then they come down to each country level and state level. Our guidelines simply say that a prison should have a library. It doesn't actually say what should be in that library. Some prisons, they don't have funding for libraries. They just have books that are donated. And, you know, some of them, they could be craft books. The irony about that is that prisoners can't have knitting needles and sewing needles. So, you know, they can look at it, but you can't actually make anything in it. And some prisoners, their library where they might get legal information, because it doesn't have to be there, could just be a tub of books. And so that's limiting. Some states do have a list of items of legal resources that should be in the library, but no one checks it and there's no funding to do it. It's just there. Prisoners also can access their legal representative, and it does say unlimited. It's in the guidelines. However, their phone calls are limited to 10 minutes. If you have a legal aid solicitor, you dial the number and then it's, you know, press number one, press number two, you're on hold. You could be on hold for your full 10 minutes and actually never get to speak to your solicitor. And then if you've got a private solicitor, it's a bit easier. Not many prisoners have the money. And then if you don't speak English, you know, if you don't have any family and friends that you can get information from. And, of course, also their mail is, anything is checked, it can be redacted. In some cases, like the argument for not having access to legal information is because they can read about fellow prisoners and that can cause issues. So if you're in a maximum security and you're in with someone who is a mass murderer, they kind of don't really want you to read about that person, the judgments on that person. And they don't have access to computers. There are standalone computers that have some information downloaded onto them, but not internet connected and no email. It's pretty tough. It's pretty tough. If you've been sentenced and depending on your crime, you might be arrested and actually never return home, because depending on what your criminal history is, also a lot of factors, you might actually be arrested, end up in the magistrate's court that night, straight into remand or wherever, and actually never go home. So what happens to everything in your house? What happens to your lease? You might be in a boarding room, in a boarding house, but what happens to all your stuff? The sheriff just comes and gets it, or it gets thrown out. So you lose potentially your identity, because you don't have a birth certificate, you don't have your driver's license. And when you leave, you literally leave prison and you're released and you have nothing and nowhere to go to. Then you could be in prison and you want access to see your children and the other party is saying no. How do you do that? You have to try and find a family law specialist. How do you do that? So it can be really complicated. Tough. Really complicated, really tough. And if you have limited access and limited skill to find information and to understand it. And, of course, as I said, we have lots of quantitative data. How many times prisoners have accessed legal aid? How many cases is legal aid resolved? I think it was something like 726 or something last year in Victoria. Well, great, but how did those prisoners feel about that? What was the outcome of their experience? We don't know.
You're listening to Stories Behind the Research on the CSU Research Hub.
So the research you're doing is going to make a significant difference to the ongoing lives of these people.
I think it's very generous to use the word significant, Dawn. In a wonderful world, we could say yes. Marion's made a significant difference. Look, to be realistic, probably won't make any significant difference. Probably the people who should read it probably won't. But I think definitely it's a step in the right direction. And if we have a better understanding of the prisoners' experiences of trying to or needing to find legal information, we can at least then, you know, perhaps use that to levy better outcomes, maybe better policies, maybe just a recognition that, oh, wow, we could do better here. That would be great. Even if just that happened, I would feel it would be worthwhile. But as I said, I think significant might be super generous word to use.
I'm just thinking of this cycle that could happen. So if someone is in prison, they don't have access to the information they need to be able to represent themselves. What does the future hold for them, you know, with them coming out, their mental health, their ability to find work, their likelihood of re-imprisonment, I guess?
Yes, exactly. Imagine if you were self-representing because you didn't qualify for legal aid, you couldn't afford a solicitor, and you're self-representing, however, you don't even actually know what forms you have to present in court and what you have to do. So you're going to fail, pretty much. And our guidelines say we will provide you with all the support you need, but in reality, we don't. So you could actually end up being in prison, maybe for something you didn't do because you couldn't actually argue your way out of it, or for a longer period of time. Like, there's so many things. You're going to be pretty grumpy, pretty mad, pretty angry. You come out of prison and you find out you've lost everything. Then you have to go through and try and get your birth certificate, get your driver's license, do all of that sort of stuff on limited funding because you're unemployed and maybe you don't have any family, and you're going to more than likely reoffend. There are supports in prison to help people to not reoffend and to get skills and to do all sorts of things. But even that is, it would be, I would imagine, exhausting. Absolutely exhausting. Then you come out and really your options are pretty limited, probably highly likely reoffend because you've kind of learned how to do that in prison a bit.
So what are you hoping your research is going to achieve? Are you thinking reform?
I think, as I said, just an acknowledgement that, you know, maybe in the states that I'm looking at, I mean, and I have to say one of the states I'm going to, because I don't want to like put any names or anything in there at the moment because I don't want to jeopardize anything I'm doing. But one of the states I'm, you know, looking at the moment, they have actually looked and they've thought about this, and they do have a pretty terrific system going there. I mean, there's been no real longitudinal studies yet to see if it has actually made a significant difference. They have kind of stepped back and gone, oh, hey, we could do better. Now, if other states could just do the same thing, and I also don't understand why other states haven't really followed the aspects of the one state that is doing better. And I think maybe it just comes down to funding. It comes down to lobbying. It comes down to so many factors. And even if just someone somewhere read it, my PhD, and went, you know what, we actually could do better. Now, I might be that person. I might finish this and end up sitting on a board of somewhere, and I get a voice. And I suppose if I can get out there and shout a bit about it once I start, fingers crossed, I start getting some data in, I don't know, I could become an activist in my old age. That would be very interesting. I think my children would go, no.
Could be a whole heap of fun.
It could be. You might find I've chained myself to the front of Barwon Prison, although it's closing soon, but Barwon Prison, who knows? Who knows where I'll end up?
You might be on the inside, Marion.
No, I've never actually. I have been in a prison, but very, very long time ago, and it would have been in the, I'm going back to how it would have been in the 1970s. Mm. And this is a little aside. So Beechworth Prison was low level, minimum security level, and the prisoners there actually in the 60s and 70s worked. Some of them would actually have a key to the front door of the prison and let themselves out and go to work and come back at the end of the day. And one of the actual prisoners there had a family whose the children didn't know that he actually lived in the prison. So it was very low security. Mm. And I happened to be living up in Albury Wodonga at that time with my parents, and my parents were actors basically, and they used to put shows on in the prison. So I kind of went occasionally. So I would perform as well, and so that's the only prison I've ever been in, and it was very nice, really. I wouldn't want to live there, but so no, I've never actually myself been in prison, but I'm so glad of you, Dawn, to suggest that maybe at the end of my PhD I could end up in one.
Thank you for joining us today, Marion, and to our listeners for tuning in. Your story has been really insightful, and I think more about the behind-the-scenes processes that people might not expect, and the resilience and the patience that sometimes needed when you undertake research. I think that that part of research and that story is important for people to understand. So if you've got a research story to share or know someone who does, we'd love to hear from you. Please reach out to us. Our email is researcherdevelopment@csu.edu.au. Keep exploring, stay curious, and until next time, keep making a difference in the world. Thanks, Marion. Thanks for listening, Dawn. Everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to Stories Behind the Research. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. To learn more about higher degree pathways, visit research@csu.edu.au. If you have a story to share and would like to be featured on our podcast, email us at researcherdevelopment@csu.edu.au.